WSLR-LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV-LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. You can find us on the web at WSLR.org. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
This is the Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barisonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them.
The stock market soars, but so does the price of everything else. Home ownership is out of reach for a growing number of people. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. But at what point does the gap between the two threaten the foundations of society? Has it always been this way? In his book, Challenging Inequalities, How We Got Stuck and Where We Go Next, Paul Johnson looks at how efforts to create a more equal society have stalled, what it means for people struggling to meet basic needs, and what we can do to remedy the situation. Paul, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you.
There was a period of time from 1910 to around 1970 where income inequality fell. How much did it fall, and what was behind that trend?
So if you look over that period, which is mostly a fair way back in history now, you got two things happening. One was that living standards rose enormously, particularly in the period after the Second World War. So incomes were growing very fast, and inequalities were falling in two ways. First of all, ownership was spreading across the population. If you look back towards the beginning of the 20th century, most people didn't own anything, really. They wouldn't have had a pension. They wouldn't have owned their own home. They'd have very little in the way of savings, and everything really was in the hands of a small aristocracy and a small number of people beyond that. So what happened over the 20th century was that earnings across the distribution grew, and that reduced income inequality because the level of earnings of your average worker increased relative to the incomes of those right at the top. And wealth inequality fell because essentially wealth became more distributed across the economy. And the key reason for that is that the economy was growing pretty well over that period.
You don't think that the tax structure had anything to do with that? And I know in the United States, at one point, we had a top tax rate that I think was 75%.
Taxes certainly played a role in that. They played a role particularly in, say, the 20 years after the Second World War through the 50s and 60s. They played a big role in breaking up some big inheritances. People began to learn how to avoid them fairly effectively after that. And you did have very, very high levels of tax right at the top of the earnings distribution and the income distribution as well. Never very effective at raising money, but probably played a role, or did play a role, at reducing after-tax inequality.
And I'm thinking, too, in the United States, it funded things like the education programs for returning soldiers and the mortgage benefits, which didn't go to all Americans, but it went to the white Americans. And you don't think that that had a big impact?
Taxation as a fraction of national income over this period grew, and it became more progressive. But that, as it were, was layered on top of a situation which is very different. Remember, by 1970, the world was very different to what it was at the turn of the century. You had a reduction in underlying income and earnings inequality and wealth inequality, which was made significantly greater by the introduction, really, of the modern welfare state in the UK. So much higher levels of taxation by 1970, much, much higher levels of taxation by 1970 than you had in 1910, and much more progressive taxation. So you're absolutely right, that played a role, but it clearly was not the only role, and I would argue probably not even the main role if you're looking at incomes, although when you're looking at people's welfare altogether, because it funded the welfare state, you've got some high people on higher incomes paying most of the tax, and you've got everybody benefiting from the health service, the pensions, and so on.
Now, don't we have the situation where a lot of the wealth is inherited instead of earned?
That's interesting. We've sort of, to some rather depressing extent, moved back. Now we're in the 21st century to where we were towards the beginning of the 20th century rather than in the middle of the 20th century. So if you look at the importance of inheritances today for the most recent generations, they're going to be much more important in their lives on average than was for the case of a generation or two before that. Now, inheritance was also incredibly important right back at the beginning of the 20th century. And again, there are two reasons for that. One is that wealth inequality, underlying levels of wealth have become much more important over the last 40 years in the UK than they were in the period, let's say, from the 1930s to the 1970s. There's a lot more wealth about, and so inheriting it is more important. The tax system, which on the face of it looks quite progressive and quite heavy, actually, the rate of inheritance tax in principle is 40% on pretty much everything over a relatively small total of about £300,000 or £400,000. But actually, it's really quite difficult to raise that whilst you had quite a short window, really, in the 1950s, where inheritance tax was much more effective, although it didn't raise any, certainly didn't raise any more than it does at the moment. It probably raises more now because it was quite effective at getting some of those very big estates.
And that's in the UK, not in the US.
I'm talking about the UK.
Yeah, in the US, the inheritance tax, I think, is pretty much non-existent anymore.
I think it varies by state, doesn't it? But it's only a relatively small fraction of people in the UK who pay it for all sorts of reasons, including the fact that many people reach the point of death with relatively low levels of assets. But more and more are paying, partly because house prices have increased over this period. It's not a terribly, whilst it is very high, 40%, it really affects what you might call the moderately wealthy much more than it affects the seriously wealthy. Because if you're seriously wealthy, you can tend to find ways of getting around it, not least by giving away a lot of your wealth before you die, because it's only an inheritance tax. It's not a tax on gifts during life. There are also clever trust-type arrangements that you can use to get around it. There are certain assets that aren't tax, whereas if you're a sort of moderately well-off person with a valuable house, for example, pretty hard to get away with not paying inheritance tax on the house that you leave to your children.
So what happened in the 1980s that caused what you describe in the book as an abrupt reversal on an extraordinary scale?
Yeah, so we had a long period up until the late 1970s where inequality was gradually falling. I should say that here we're talking about income inequality across the population. There are some sorts of inequalities that have got a lot better. So inequality between men and women, inequality between different people from different ethnicities, much, much lower now than it was in the 1970s. But if you look across the sort of distribution of households there, or distribution of earnings, income inequality rose at an astonishing and a historically astounding rate during the 1980s. And there were several things going on at that time. We had, at the bottom of the distribution, as it were, we had very sharp deindustrialization. We had a closing of a lot of the old industries and a lot of people ending up on not very generous welfare support. At the top end, you had wages rising really quite fast in some of the professional services and some of the newer industries, particularly in London and the South East at the time, and a booming economy. Actually, booming economy that saw the average person doing really quite well, and people at the top doing really incredibly well, and people at the bottom not getting worse off on average, but certainly not getting any better off over that period. And that increased, or however you measure it, that increased income inequality, earnings inequality, really to an astonishing extent and a historically unprecedented level. And the remarkable thing is that for most of the population, things have kind of stuck where they were in about 1990. If you look across most of the distribution, things haven't changed a great deal in terms of income and earnings inequality for quite a long time now. Although right at the top 1 or 2%, they did continue to pull away and pull away quite fast up until the financial crisis of 2008. You look at the period since 2008, and even that top group have, if anything, seen their incomes fall a bit relative to the average, and certainly not continue to pull away.
Really? The statistics I've seen say that the billionaires made out big time during COVID.
It depends who we're talking about here. So I said the top 1 or 2%. The billionaires are the top 0.0001%. I mean, so again, it depends which part of the distribution you're looking at. So the top 1% in the UK is really, broadly speaking, people who are earning over about £200,000. But to get to the top 0.1%, you need to be knocking on for £1 million. There's huge differences within that top 1%. And then obviously billionaires, they've got £1 million. And so you've kind of got, you do need to be careful about what you're talking about here. And when I'm talking about inequality, I'm generally not talking about the few dozen billionaires or 100 billionaires or whatever the number is we got in the UK. Whilst they're important in terms of the amount of wealth they have, in terms of the number of people they are, they're just a tiny, whiny, teeny-weeny number. Now, it doesn't make them unimportant, but when I talk about inequality, I'm talking about everybody, not just worrying about the five people at the top.
Yeah, it's kind of the five people at the top that worry me, because what we've seen in the United States, where they've basically captured our democratic processes.
That's one of the things we do talk about in the book, is the extent to which, particularly when you've got that level of income, of wealth inequality, you can have that capture. You can have some of that capture at the top. Now, I think what's happening in the US is significantly more extreme at that end than what we've got in the UK. It's important in the UK, but it's not on the same sort of level as your top billionaires in the US.
So you think the U.S. is a special case in the amount of influence the billionaires have on the democratic processes?
I mean, the amount of money that swirls around American politics is in an entirely different league to any other country that I'm aware of. So I'm certainly not saying that the UK is immune from this, and there are some things that from the US perspective will look astonishing. There are clearly people in our second chamber, the House of Lords, who are largely there because they've given significant amounts of money to political parties, and there certainly have been very wealthy people who have given significant amounts to political parties, and of course there is all of the lobbying you see elsewhere, but actually it is on a minuscule scale compared with the kind of lobbying that you see in the US.
I was shocked to see the statistic that 90% of the top 0.1% are male. I guess this is a byproduct of the patriarchy? They've got all the cards? How does this happen?
So we're flipping between wealth and income here. You're talking about the top 0.1% by income there, and that top 0.1% will tend to be people very senior in the finance industry in the UK, particularly, probably more focused on finance than it is in the US. The chief executives of very big companies, some people rise at the top of the tech industries, and they do remain overwhelmingly male, yes.
So women are more educated than men now. According to what you had in your book, women are getting college degrees more than men. Yeah. How has this affected the pay gap between men and women?
So if you look at the sort of average pay gap, that has come down over time because women are, as you say, doing much better in education than men at the moment. And indeed, there's a serious worry about the very poor performance of many boys from lower socioeconomic groups who are doing appallingly in our education system. That's a worldwide issue to some extent. If you look in the labour market, what you see is that the average gap has fallen reasonably significantly over a long period of time because women have become much more educated. But if you look within education groups, so if you compare a female graduate to a male graduate, that gap sort of stopped closing really a good 20 years ago. So we've made almost no progress in the male-female gap between people of the same education level over the last 20 years. Been a little bit of progress among lower educated because women are the most likely to be benefiting from our minimum wage, and the minimum wage has gone up really quite significantly over the last 15 years. So the story really, and particularly over the last 20 years, has been a stalling in progress, particularly for the better educated.
When you say that the minimum wage has increased, then you meant in the UK.
Yes, yeah, I'm talking about the UK here, yeah. It's extraordinary what's happened in the UK. The minimum wage in the UK has gone from not having one at all 30 years ago to a relatively low one to just about the highest in the world, which is an astonishing change over a 30-year period.
Because we don't have a similar situation in the United States. Adjusted for inflation, the minimum wage hasn't really gone up at all.
It's been a strange bit of politics over here. This was introduced by a left-wing government in the late 1990s, and then really was opposed by the Conservatives. But then about a decade ago, the Conservatives then accepted it, and then about a decade ago, they started to really hike it up. I think because they saw it as a way of looking as if they were improving the outcomes for poorer workers without spending any money, frankly. So we've now ended up in this remarkable place where we've got, by international standards, one of the two or three highest in the world.
All Faiths Food Bank depends on local volunteers for their food distribution programs. Each month, there are 870 grocery pickup opportunities, and last year, 20.4 million meals were distributed to children, families, seniors, veterans, and others in crisis. Volunteer opportunities include sorting and packing food, distributing at pantries, participating in nutrition education and cooking classes, office assistants, helping at events, and more. More information is available at allfaithsfoodbank.org. You're listening to the Progressive Page Turner. My guest is Paul Johnson, and we're talking about his book, Challenging Inequalities. What effect does the inequality have on health?
There are big gaps in life expectancy according to your income, wealth, education, and where you live, to the extent that for people living in the poorest areas in the UK, they live up to 10 years less than people living in the richest areas. That's a huge difference in life expectancy. And all of this seems to be related, or is related, to essentially everything else that goes on in the economy and through people's lives. So if you're born in a poor area or to poorer parents, you probably have a less good experience as a child, and that actually makes a difference to your long-term health. If you have poorer education, you end up with a less good job, and we know that people in jobs where they've got less control over what they're doing and so on are more stressed, and stress has a really big effect on your health. You may live in a less healthy environment. You may be engaged in less healthy lifestyles, particularly if you end up being made unemployed or long-term unemployed. That's bad for your health. And the consequence of all of these things through life is that health is much better for people who have had better off parents, who have earned more, have got better education, than it is for less well-off people. Now, again, one of the big differences of the US is this is absolutely not created by our health system. Health inequalities are entirely down to experiences of people over their lives and not by how the health system treats them. My view really is that big inequalities in health and the big inequalities in longevity that you see, really they are the end point of all of the other inequalities that you see through life. So there's no single silver bullet for dealing with that. It really is about everything, about the welfare system, about work, about housing, about education, about everything from, really from cradle to grave, which comes out in the end in terms of your health in later life.
What do you think of universal basic income?
So universal basic income is a very different idea, obviously, and it depends on what you want to achieve with it. But what people, I think, tend to want to achieve with it is to provide people with an income which is just about enough to live on, so it gives them a degree of freedom, and also it takes away all of the need for all of the other welfare benefits that we have. My view is that that is wildly out of reach. Just that income will probably take about a quarter of the entire output of the country just to pay that. If you thought that you wanted people to have a quarter of average earnings, that was enough to live on, and that by definition almost is a quarter of the national income just to pay for it. It's an idea that's knocked around for 100 years and more, and there's a reason that it's never been done anywhere in the world, because it's not remotely a realistic policy.
What is China shock?
So this is something that has been particularly evident in the US. China effectively joined the international trading system around about the turn of the century and produced lots of cheap products through its manufacturing sector and competed with a lot of manufacturing in Europe and in the US. One of the consequences of that was a lot of industry in Europe and the US went out of business. And when that happened in particular communities, that could be disastrous. So the local factory closes down, it's the main employer, and the consequence is that everyone's thrown out of work and the community falls apart. And there's lots of evidence in the US particularly that really did result in particular communities, things going really badly. And Angus Deaton and Anne Case have written these extraordinary books about deaths of despair, which are not just about those places that have been impacted by that kind of competition, but really illustrate the dire consequences that can occur when in a community all the jobs go. And again, there have been lots of US economists who have looked at this very closely and related the introduction of Chinese competition to the loss of jobs in manufacturing in the US, but also in the UK and Spain and elsewhere.
What do you think the impact of AI is going to be if a lot of white-collar jobs are basically outsourced to AI the way the manufacturing jobs were outsourced to China?
I don't know the answer to that, and I think anyone who says they do know the answer is being somewhat overconfident in their predictions. It looks like we're seeing impact at the moment, in particular in the graduate labour market. So young people coming out of university would normally go into entry-level white-collar jobs. The number of those jobs seems, certainly in the UK, seems to have dropped really quite significantly in the last year or two. And if you don't get into these jobs in the first year or two after graduation, that can have a long-term negative effect on your earnings and welfare. So that's something we're beginning to see. The longer-term impacts, I think it's very hard to know. And possible that what this will do is make lots of people more productive. You know, what's happened in the past when people become more productive is not that we've ended up with fewer jobs, we've just ended up with more stuff. So when you go back to the Industrial Revolution and people used to sort of have to spin cotton to make clothes, and then you get machines to make far more clothes with far fewer people. But that didn't result in the long run in nobody having a job. It put out the cotton spinners, I'm probably getting the terms wrong here, out of job, and that was terrible for them in the short run, but in the long run, not so much. Now, it could be AI is like that. So it'll have a short-term negative effect on a lot of people, which would be very difficult to deal with, but in the long run, we'll all be better off. Or it could be that it's so different and so able to do so much stuff that it replaces so much of what we do that there'll be fewer jobs in total around. And I don't think we know which of those it's going to be. I mean, because everything always up till now has been in the first category, I kind of hope and believe it will be in that first category, but I think there are reasons for fearing it might be in the second.
There's been this vision that once we got robots doing all the work, people would have lots of leisure time. And what we've seen is instead, what happened with the China shock, instead of people having more leisure time, they're just out of jobs and have no way of participating in the economy. You were talking in the book about how London is the center of the economic prosperity in the UK. When you look at the U.S., the same thing is true. The cities are the economic centers, and the rest of the country is getting poorer and poorer.
Yeah. I mean, the difference in the U.K. is it's only London. It's not the cities. It's just London.
But a lot of that was because of the loss of manufacturing jobs and this growth of financial jobs. Is that correct?
It's always been a bit of a financial centre, but it's become much more of a financial centre, but a professional services centre as well, but also a lot of creative industry, increasingly a tech hub, but not in the level of Silicon Valley, but certainly by European standards, a pretty large tech hub. So when you've got a city that big and that prospering, it pulls people in and can get into a positive cycle. And that was, to some extent, in recent history, kicked off by what happened in the 1980s. It's worth saying a couple of additional things. London is also, and this is often true of big cities, also much the most unequal bit of the UK. So there's an awful lot of poor people in London. The difference between London and the rest of the country is not so much that there are fewer low-income people in London, it's just there are a lot more high-income people. I think you'll find the same in most US cities, the big successful cities as well. I think one of the worrying things for us over here is that London has not done very well over the last decade, which might be related to Brexit. It might be related to the fact it's incredibly difficult to build anything in London because of our planning laws, and so it's become very expensive. But one of the things I think is quite worrying is that it hasn't done very well for the last decade.
The US is very reluctant to interfere with the marketplace, even though it's extremely inefficient. For example, we have millions of vacant houses and all these people living on the streets. Should we let things go with letting the marketplace decide, or do we need to start making decisions about how we want the world to look instead of letting the marketplace decide it?
That's a good question. One of my views about the UK, and actually I think a lot of people think this about US cities as well, is that one of the problems is we don't let the marketplace decide about building particularly. So what is, in my view, the biggest creator of both inequality and economic decline in the UK? It's almost impossible to build stuff. It's incredibly expensive to build stuff, and we've got incredibly difficult regulation to deal with. I think London built like something like 8,000 homes last year against a target of 80,000 when we've got some of the most expensive housing in the world. It's incredibly expensive to build infrastructure, power stations, railway lines and so on. And that's not because the market's failing, that's because the state is failing in a really big way. But there are other areas where you might think the state should be stepping in when it looks like we've got some very poor communities, particularly coastal areas that have been left behind. You know, when we've had those big shifts in the 1980s where whole industries collapsed, and there was a kind of assumption that the market would deal with it, that jobs would go to those places, you know, but everything would sort of equilibrate in a way. And that hasn't happened. And actually, we should have had more state intervention there. So I suppose my concern is that we've done it in exactly the wrong way and in exactly the wrong places. The state has got in the way where it shouldn't have done, and it hasn't provided support where it should have done.
One of the scenarios that goes through my head is, as we've moved away from making physical things and the money is going to jobs, like you said, in finance or creative areas, and then those are the areas that AI actually excels at, and then the money from the AI companies are going to that very, very small number of billionaires, mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like that's being addressed at all.
Well, as I say, I think that's a different way of asking the same question we discussed just now about what the long-run effect of AI will be on jobs. And as I say, I just don't know. There's an optimistic scenario and there's a pessimistic scenario, and you're painting the pessimistic one, which I think is possible. I do think that is a serious concern. What you're asking is, as it were, a standard, at one level, a standard question about how you deal with monopolies or with companies that have got massive market power. In some ways, we're back to the Gilded Age in the US, where you've got the set of railroads or steel or what have you, a small number of people making vast amounts of money because they've got monopolies. You're getting the same in tech. And I think that is an area, actually, where government should get involved, because the consequence of that is, whilst these people have arguably, at least, you delivered huge benefits by developing, whether it's iPhones or whether it's AI or whether it's all of the other amazing tech things that the consumers want, they've also often themselves then ended up with so much market power, they are either stopping entry from other potential competitors or they're playing an excessively large role in politics or what have you. I think at that point you do need to get into a world in which you are appropriately regulating them and potentially taxing them. Now that's much harder than it used to be, partly because these things are internationally competitive, but I think it's probably easier in the US because the US is such a huge economy. It'd be actually easier for you than it is for us to do that.
Along with the most pessimistic scenario of AI is, once that happens, it'll be almost impossible to tax the super wealthy because they've captured the democratic processes. So I think it makes sense to start working on those sort of policies before AI gets even more monopolistic. You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest has been Paul Johnson, and we've been talking about his book,